Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International Law and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, February 28, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will hear about the recent travel moratorium executive order. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Andrew C. McCarthy, Senior Fellow at the National Review Institute, David J. Beer, Immigration Policy Analyst at Cato Institute Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity, and finally, Shireen Qudsi, Director of Muslim Matters at America Matters. I'll turn it over to Shireen to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Shireen. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Laura, and thank you, everyone, for the invitation to be part of this conversation. The public reaction we saw to the executive order was, in fact, moral outrage, which then triggered calls for legal opposition. That opposition is based on humanizing the news cycle, focused on the people who are affected by the ban, the immigrants and the refugees. But what we're seeing isn't sound legal analysis. Instead, we're seeing emotional, knee-jerk reactions based on binary systems of thought, that something is either good or bad. I'd like to briefly share my story with you. My family escaped Afghanistan during the Soviet invasion, and we ended up as asylum seekers in Germany, having first traveled through Pakistan, then Iran, and Turkey. We lived in Germany for 2 years before we moved to the United States. So this issue of refugees is close to my heart. I was a refugee. I know what it's like to be an immigrant over and over again. And I understand the generational challenges we face. So here's the other side of the story. The legal battle also isn't taking into account. Moving from a Muslim country to a Western country is like going from one world into another. It brings immense conflict and struggles for integration, struggles that I feel are heightened now by identity politics and a larger resistance to encourage acculturation. It took me over 10 years to adjust to the United States. It took my parents a lot longer, and some people don't ever quite adjust to their new environment. Instead, they long for the familiarity of what they've always known of as home. One of the reasons why acculturation is so difficult is because American values are often in direct opposition to the values of Eastern cultures and some of their belief systems. So if we're going to humanize the travel moratorium, we need to look at the full picture. First, we need to build safe zones, something President Trump was working on with the Saudis to create restrained refugees. Refugees can be handled more cost-effectively in the Middle East than by bringing them to the United States. The goal right now is to scale back refugee entry to what it was 15 years ago before Obama ramped it up. Second, we need to target the real problem that's creating refugees: regional war, and specifically the growing problem of radical Islam, which devastates first and foremost local Muslim populations. The previous administration added to the current refugee crisis by allowing ISIS to grow. The administrations prior to that also fueled the problem by not tackling the ideology and instead struggling with the spring of new factions and groups that rose through destabilizing foreign intervention. The issue of travel moratorium and the larger discussion of who we should let into this country rests firmly on the question of values. We have to ask ourselves, do we want to bring in a flood of people from parts of the world who adhere to and who do not challenge primitive legal codes such as Sharia law? The value of immigration in decades prior placed emphasis on the talent people brought with them. Today, we need to look at the ideas people bring with them. If an individual carries with them a belief system that sees women as property or believes homosexuals are abnormal or need to be punished, then that belief system doesn't belong in a civilized world. It doesn't belong in American society. In fact, having an influx of people who hold oppositional views to fundamental human rights we cherish as Americans is, in fact, a detriment to American society. And yet, as part of their legal protests, select states have argued that the executive order is a discrimination against Muslims. It hurts citizens within that state. As a Muslim writer and activist, I want to stress that I and many other Muslims collectively feel it is a myth to think this is a religious ban or a Muslim ban. Instead, I'm calling for us to look at the facts we need to bring into this picture. What does the executive order really discriminate against? The executive order on travel and immigration is first and foremost a temporary turning off for 90 days from red flag states identified under the Obama administration. The refugee resettlement program is suspended for 4 months, a move that is within our rights since the only people who have rights against deportation and indefinite detention are American citizens. Further, the moratorium's focus is on non-refugees. It's on active, radicalized jihadis infiltrating through the refugee channels. In countries with constant political turmoil and failed security, it is incredibly difficult to vet people thoroughly. The only thing we are discriminating for and need to be discriminating against is ideology. Second, what is the underlying threat? The assumption that citizens within a state will be affected by the travel moratorium ignores the larger issues of values which I have pointed out. To add further, allowing in poorly vetted candidates puts our communities at risk. There is the additional consideration that because these are candidates from territories with hardline ideologies, the likelihood increases significantly that while they are not coming in radicalized, perhaps, they are prone to radicalization, especially when their value systems are challenged, when they haven't acculturated, and when we haven't been able to effectively counter homegrown radicalization. And third, what is the rule of law? To quote attorney Karen Lugo, a director at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, in most cases when individuals or states sue the federal government, there is a threshold question of whether there is standing to bring the complaint. In this case, the states must ultimately prove that they will suffer irreparable harm. Meeting these legal standards will be very difficult. The First Amendment complaints that are part of the litigation are problematic for the basic reason that our Constitution does not offer religious exercise or discrimination protection to people in other countries who are not yet on our soil. Also, the Constitution vests authority in the executive to decide affairs with foreign nations, unquote. Section 212F of the Immigration and Nationality Act also gives the President power by proclamation and for such a period as he shall deem necessary, suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens as immigrants or non-immigrants. Ultimately, we need to remember America is not a charitable organization. We need to look at whether immigration benefits our nation. We need to invoke powerful and uncomfortable questions that ask whether immigration pathways offer value to our society or are they a future detriment. Thank you. I'll turn it over to David Beer.
Thank you, Shireen. Let me start off by saying that I appreciate the Federalist Society for hosting this teleconference. For me, this executive order is mainly a statutory question of whether or not it's legal. Justice Kennedy's controlling opinion in U.S. v. Dinn held that in cases that curtail the rights of U.S. citizens, the consular officer may deny visas only for, quote, facially legitimate and bona fide reasons. This vague term is not defined, but it starts with, as Kennedy put it, the congressional power to make rules for the exclusion of aliens. So the most central question here is whether Congress authorized the action that the president seeks to carry out. The administration relies on Section 212F of the Immigration and Nationality Act, or the INA. That provision allows the president to, quote, suspend the entry of any class of aliens whenever he finds that their entry would be detrimental to the interest of the United States. Section 202A of the INA, however, provides that with certain exceptions, no person shall receive any preference or priority or be discriminated against in the issuance of an immigrant visa because of the person's race, sex, nationality, place of birth, or place of residence. So on their face, these two statutes conflict. One allows discrimination in any manner, and the other bans it in a specific cases. In the case of a conflict, the first rule of statutory construction is, as the Supreme Court has put it, to give effect to each statute. On this point, the government in the state of Washington versus Donald Trump provided no argument that Section 202A, the ban on discrimination, would still have effect if the president could choose to waive it at any time, for any duration, and for any reason. Obviously, this is because there is no such argument. The prohibition in Section 202 clearly reads as a restriction on executive authority. And so if the president can override this restriction whenever he wants, it ceases to have effect, meaning it no longer would act as a meaningful constraint. The second rule of construction is that the later enacted statute should be seen as limiting the earlier one. And Section 212F was enacted in 1952, and Section 202A, which bars discrimination, was enacted later in 1965, amending the earlier law. Judge Robart, during oral arguments in the State of Washington case, considered this point very important, stating that Congress had to be aware of Section 212F, but chose to enact the sweeping prohibition against discrimination anyway. The third rule is that the more specific statute should be seen as limiting the more general one. Section 212F is a broad, sweeping authority that can be applied to any alien seeking to enter, whereas Section 202A, discrimination ban, applies only to a narrow subset of aliens, namely immigrants, that is, people who are sponsored by U.S. family members or U.S. employers and are coming to the United States to live permanently. So not covered by the discrimination prohibition are refugees or non-immigrants, temporary visitors, tourists, and the like. That's my argument. Presents only an as-applied challenge to the executive order, since temporary visitors and tourists could be banned by Section 212F, assuming banning them does not violate the Establishment Clause of the Constitution if it was based on religious discrimination. The fourth rule of construction states that in cases where Congress provided for specific exceptions from a general rule, anything not listed in the exceptions is considered to be excluded from them. As Judge Robart emphasized in the State of Washington case, Section 202 makes a number of exceptions but does not accept Section 212F, providing a good reason to believe that Congress did not want to exempt that provision from the bar on discrimination. Finally, the fifth rule states that in cases of ambiguity, the tie goes to the interpretation that best fits with the entire statutory scheme. As Justice Scalia stated in a 1988 decision, a provision that may seem ambiguous in isolation is often clarified by the remainder of the statutory scheme. In this case, as the government itself admits, the statutory scheme of the 1965 amendments was to create a system of immigration that is unbiased. This point really cannot be overstated. Congress debated the question at length about whether it is in the interest of the United States to discriminate based on national origin, as the original 1952 Act did, and it concluded that it was not in our interest. It not only passed this sweeping and unequivocal prohibition on nationality-based discrimination in Section 202, but the rest of that very section also provided that each country receive an equal share of the immigrant visas issued each year. Perhaps it could be argued that there's an exception for difficult-to-vet countries, and this is exactly what the administration argues. But this was also a popular argument for discrimination in the 1952 Act. During the 1965 debate, opponents of allowing in Asian immigrants who were heavily discriminated against in the 1952 Act made the point that, as Congressman O.C. Fisher put it, the problem of procuring background information to screen out subversives becomes increasingly difficult in Asia because most of the background information regarding communist activities would be located in Oriental communist countries and hence unavailable to our security officials. So Congressman Fisher's argument here is nearly verbatim the government's argument today. Not only did Congress reject this argument, it repeatedly emphasized that foreign policy and national security of the United States would benefit from the non-discrimination rule. As then New York Senator Jacob Javits stated, nationality-based immigration was a target of communist propaganda, making our efforts to win over uncommitted nations more difficult. This argument applies in equal force today with regard to ISIS or radical Islamic propaganda, which is being aided by this immigration ban. The government has also argued that perhaps the 1952 law and the 1965 amendment may not be in conflict because the 1965 law only deals with visa issuance rather than entry of people into the country. But this argument is also specious. First of all, the executive order does apply to visa issuance as well as entry, which is why consulates canceled interviews for all visa applicants from these countries. And more to the point, the decision to allow someone to enter the United States is ultimately the decision about whether they're eligible for a visa, as the law itself makes perfectly clear. If you are found ineligible to enter the United States, your visa is revoked, meaning that it is unissued. And as I have already stated, all decisions related to the issuance of visas cannot take into account nationality. I will note that there is almost no case law on the discrimination provisions of Section 202A and none that directly deal with it in relation to 212F. The only relevant case is from 1995 when the D.C. Circuit found that the foreign affairs power of the president could not be used to discriminate against Vietnamese applying for immigrant visas in Hong Kong. The president had suspended visa issuance to them in order to require them to apply in Vietnam itself. This case prompted Congress to amend the 1965 Act to allow the president to require applicants to apply at certain locations. And in light of the congressional action, the Supreme Court remanded the case and the lower court reversed. But the reasoning of the original D.C. Circuit decision provides a blueprint for bringing a challenge based on a blanket ban on visa issuance to a certain nationality. In conclusion, I would just reiterate that no court has ever found that the president can ignore the plain meaning of immigration law in the name of national security. Indeed, President Obama argued this point in 2015 when he attempted an end run around Congress to provide lawful status to unauthorized aliens. He claimed that identifying the undocumented people would benefit national security and claimed that focusing on violent offenders was in the security interest of the United States. He was undoubtedly correct as a factual matter on both of these points, and courts are also ill-equipped to reject such a fact-based security conclusion. But it didn't matter. The Fifth Circuit rejected them anyway. Congress writes the immigration laws and not the president, and the same conclusion applies here. Thank you for listening, and here's Andrew McCarthy.
Thanks so much, David. I feel in a lot of ways that we're arguing over an empty bag. The executive order in question was never meant to be anything but temporary. It certainly was not, as I respectfully disagree with David for suggesting, an effort to set up a new system of immigration. It was quickly suspended, more in my view, for what that's worth, over the ham-handed way in which it was implemented than anything else, which certainly gave critics of it a big target to shoot at. And regardless of what one thinks of the reasoning behind the judicial suspension decisions, the order is almost certain to be rescinded, probably within a matter of days. It is very possible that the successor order will make the discussion that we're having today academic at best. Maybe a number of these questions will still be relevant. Maybe they'll have been narrowed. But I think we're, at this point, arguing over what is likely to be past history pretty quickly. Of more consequence from my point of view, the executive order has also, and the aftermath of it, has also complicated, maybe fatally, the potential for arriving at an ultimately sensible policy. Again, we should remain mindful that the eventual goal of this policy is not to exclude aliens from specific countries or in a specific legal status, such as refugees. The goal is to arrive at a vetting procedure that will adequately respect any rights that the affected aliens may arguably have, and at the same time give the nation confidence that we are not allowing into our society aliens that will threaten our society. In positing this goal, I'm mindful, out of very personal experience, of the imperative of identifying our Muslim allies as well as our Sharia supremacist enemies. I'm reminded of why that is so when I was listening to Shireen's very poignant remarks at the beginning of our session here. The first Muslims I met when I investigated and prosecuted jihadists in the early to mid 90s were not terrorists. They were patriotic Muslims who helped us prevent terrorist attacks and build our case. And without them, tens of thousands of New Yorkers may very well have lost their lives in light of the horrific attack that was being planned in the aftermath of the World Trade Center bombing in 1993. So I just want to say that I've never believed that the main challenge that we have in terms of the refugee issue, as it's been argued over the last number of months, is to defend against the possibility that trained jihadists will infiltrate the United States by melding into refugee populations. That's obviously a challenge, and given the damage that can be done by even a single terrorist attack, it's not a challenge that we can ignore. But the long-range challenge is the infiltration of assimilation-resistant populations, which will form into Sharia supremacist enclaves in which jihadism thrives. That is to say, I'm less worried about the terrorist attack of tomorrow than I am about the terrorist attacks and related threats to liberty 3, 5, 7 years from now, if we're not careful about the system that we have for allowing people into the country, and the kind of vetting that's appropriate for those purposes, which I think is going to have to be not nation-based, but ideologically based. And ultimately, that'll result in a very difficult legal challenge, that is, figuring out what vetting protocols will pass constitutional muster and at the same time enable us to thwart terrorist attacks. Again, by the time we get to that, I think what we're arguing about today will be long forgotten. All that said, and with due respect to David, I simply don't see the executive order as legally that difficult to justify, the Ninth Circuit and the other judicial decisions notwithstanding. And I think probably the center point of our disagreement involves both executive power and the canons of interpreting statutes. I want to be clear at the outset that I'm addressing this simply as a legal conclusion, not a policy conclusion. As a matter of policy, I think the argument is well taken that too much emphasis has been placed on 7 countries that account for 15% or less of the global Islamic population from which the Sharia supremacist threat comes. I think it's ironic to hear that argument made by people whose fundamental objection is that we should not be considering Islam at all. Nevertheless, it's a point well taken. As a matter of law, though, it seems clear to me that we're dealing with a situation in which the president is at the pinnacle of his lawful power and in which the court's role is questionable. Just to make it stark by taking an example, if we were being invaded across one of our borders by soldiers or other operatives of a particular country, I don't have the slightest doubt that the president would have the authority to ban entry by nationals of that country. He would not need an act of Congress to do it. He could do it on the basis of his own authority under Article II, which includes taking whatever measures are necessary to thwart a threat from an alien force to the United States. In the instance that we're actually dealing with, the president was dealing not only under his own inherent authority, but under a sweeping grant of authority from Congress, as David has described. Consequently, he was at the height of his power in the sense that there were circumstances involving a foreign threat to national security in which Congress granted him whatever supporting authority it could provide by statute to quell the threat. Foreign threats to national security are traditionally the bailiwick of the political branches in which the courts have little, if any, role, that is, in responding to those threats. In this instance, the statute in question, the earlier the 58th statute, expressly committed the decision to the president in his judgment about whether it was whether the aliens who would be allowed in would pose a threat to the United States. It was not a decision that was left to the president as overseen by the judiciary. The argument that the 65 statute, which prohibits categorical bans based on race, national origin, and the like, repealed the earlier statute is not, to my mind, persuasive. We generally assume, in terms of what canons of construction apply here, that statutes are not repealed by implication. There's no indication in the 65 statute of a congressional intention to repeal the earlier statute. Moreover, were it to be read this way, and I think this is the key issue and maybe my key statutory departure from David, I don't think the first rule of the road here is to give effect to both statutes. I think the first rule of constitutional interpretation is not to indulge an interpretation that will create a constitutional problem if an alternative interpretation is possible. And I think if you read the statute in the way that David is suggesting, it would undermine the president's constitutional authority to react to foreign threats to national security at the border. It's not necessary to read the statute in a way that creates that constitutional difficulty. There's, in fact, an easy way to give effect to both statutes. The 65 statute quite properly prohibits a framework for immigration that would institutionalize racism or prejudice based on national origin. The 52 statute, to the contrary, authorizes the president to deal on a temporary basis with threats to national security. I don't think it's at all difficult to read those two provisions as in harmony. And I don't think that by reacting to a threat to national security, the president should be deemed to be trying to set up a framework for immigration or otherwise supersede the framework that that Congress has established. I don't, by the way, have any quarrel with David's point that it is for Congress to set up the framework for immigration. And I also, for what it's worth, on his last point, I quite agree with him that it's that it would be a frivolous objection to distinguish the issuance of visas from entry. I think his point on that is compelling as well. I just don't agree that you need to read these two statutes as if they were in conflict. Finally, if Congress had intended to prohibit categorizations based on national origin, it is highly unlikely that Congress itself would have engaged in drawing such categories. But that is precisely what Congress did in the Obama-era statute on which the Trump executive order relies, the order that was the basis for designating the seven countries in question that we alluded to earlier. I certainly would not argue that the Obama-era statute repeals the 65 statute by implication, But I don't think such an argument would make any less sense than one claiming that the 65 statute repealed the 52 statute by implication. I would also note that when Congress enacted and the president signed the Obama-era statute, I don't recall any objections. Maybe there were some and they escaped my attention, but I don't recall any objection that that the Obama-era statute was a transgression of the 65 statute. That seems to be a fairly new argument. If I'm wrong about that, then I'm wrong, but I certainly don't recall that. So anyway, I guess our two main points of contention are, I think that there is a powerful argument from executive authority to be made here. I appreciate the potential to overuse those kinds of arguments, particularly on the basis of national security, but when we're talking about foreign entry into the United States over the border, that seems to me to be a pretty classic case of appropriate national security concern where executive authority is a strong factor. And again, I just simply don't believe that it's necessary to read these two statutes as if they were in conflict. So thank you very much for your attention, and thank you for inviting me.
All right. Well, before we go to questions, I'd like to give everyone a chance to respond to each other. Shireen, do you have anything you'd like to respond to, or David?
Yeah, I love what David was saying in regards to 12 really being statutory questions. When it comes to 202, what I find missing here is that while it's really fleshed out and it targets race, nationality, and ethnicity, we're ultimately dealing with an ideology, and that's the exceptional challenge we have, and perhaps we don't have the correct statute to really address this current problem at this time. The other point that David pointed out was he was mentioning that the ban or the rhetoric empowers ISIS, but ultimately our playbook can't be determined by what ISIS thinks. We have to look at our unique challenges, and what we're dealing with right now is the fact that this ideology escapes through borders, through nation states, and we're dealing with something that's much more fluid in its ability to reach different population groups. And I would like to add that I completely agree with Andrew in terms of vetting procedures. That's a big problem here. But the larger issue is absolutely, as Andrew pointed out, that the infiltration of, assimilation-resistant populations, that's a huge problem because, as I mentioned in my opening statement, when you have population groups that come here that do not acculturate, that do not assimilate, we openly have those Islamist populations talking about electing Sharia-compliant judges, electing Sharia-compliant presidents even, to that point where their ultimate goal, and we're not talking about radicals at this point, we're talking about people who are law-abiding but Islamist in the nature of how they wish to subvert the American system and judicial system. Their ultimate goal is to supplement an American constitution with an Islamic, we can call it a caliphate, call it an Islamic state. That's the ultimate goal, and that ultimately is a bigger threat than the kinetic war.
Yeah, so I just had a couple of points in response to Andrew. You know, one of the things that he says is that he didn't remember any objections based on the 1965 Act to the Obama-era changes to the visa waiver program, and these changes discriminated against certain tourists here temporarily who are nationals of these seven countries that President Obama had banned. And what those changes required is that they had to get a visa. They couldn't be waived from the requirement to have a visa, have a document, be interviewed before coming here. The most important point on this is that the visa waiver program changes had no impact whatsoever on Section 202A, which bans discrimination against immigrants, people who are coming to the United States as permanent residents. And so, you know, it only affected tourists as opposed to immigrants, which are protected from discrimination. Even still, I think it's odd to point to a statute where Congress explicitly created a way for these people to come to the United States as a basis for denying them that ability. I don't understand how those two can be rationalized. The other thing that I would say is he said that there was no indication of congressional intention to repeal the earlier statute. I think if you read the statute, it starts off by saying, except as specifically provided in paragraph 2 and a couple of other explicit exceptions, no person can be discriminated against based on nationality. And so within that provision, there is a good reason for thinking that they specifically intended it to apply across the board to all prior statutes. The other thing that he mentioned is that there might be a distinction here. Section 212F only applies to national security, and you know the other one, Section 202, only bars discrimination if it's racist or you know motivated by racist concerns. But Section 212F doesn't use the words national security or protection. It uses the word detrimental to describe those aliens who the president can bar. If Section 212F allows discrimination based on national origin, it would allow it not only in cases of national security, but whenever the president determines that their entrance is detrimental. Such a vague and general criteria that could be based on nearly anything. And in statutory interpretation, as I said before, the rule is that the specific trumps the general. And in this case, the specific and narrow prohibition on discrimination limits that general power in 212F to prevent the entry of someone. So, you know, I would say that 212F, if Andy's interpretation is correct, would basically get rid of the discrimination ban in the law, and the president could ban whoever he wanted based on whatever criteria he wanted, and that's clearly not what Congress intended.
Yeah, I would just respond on that last point that I think if you look at that provision within the framework of the broader statute, which speaks to a number of different bases for exclusion, that informs us about what detrimental means. And it clearly is along the lines of things that are threatening to the country. They talk about terrorist training, totalitarian ideology, public health reasons, and the like. So I don't think it's any basis that popped into the president's head that he might deem to be detrimental. And I also think the language of the provision is suggestive of the notion that this is a temporary measure to respond to an emergent situation, clearly not a framework for an immigration process, although I quite agree that if someone were of a mind in a roguish way to interpret the statute in a way that it was not intended to be applied and to try to apply it that way, then of course there could be an abusive application of it. And at that point, I imagine that it would be on Congress to react. But I think as designed, the statute is clearly intended to empower the president to deal with an emergent threat to public safety if it's read in the context of that statutory provision, which includes a number of those types of scenarios.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Let's go to our first question. Go ahead, caller.
This is Karen Lugo, and first I'd like to thank Shireen for being on the call today and for providing perspective from a constitutionally supportive Muslim as we begin to have the kinds of conversations in both the public square and legislative forums that begin to seek definitions and standards. Muslims like Shireen have interesting and very important perspective to provide. My question is for Andy McCarthy. As 31 states have expressed concerns and varying degrees of alarm regarding the existing dubious vetting policies, what might these states do together at the point that they want to express what kinds of standards, kinds of concerns that they have? What might they do to support the revised moratorium, and what value might that be?
Karen, I mean, to my mind, if we were in the original understanding of the Constitution, the federal government's role would be fairly narrow, and that would be to prescribe the conditions of lawful entry and presence into the United States, and obviously to protect the border, particularly in a emergency type situation. But I think initially, immigration enforcement, as opposed to immigration terms, was something that was supposed to be dealt with at the state level. And, you know, over the last century plus, the courts essentially, I think, first on fairly reasonable grounds, manufactured a federal enforcement role. And as seems inevitably to happen, the federal enforcement role that was supposed to coexist with what was presumed to be a state responsibility essentially edged the states out as the courts extravagantly interpreted preemption to really block the states from taking meaningful action in places where this now federal responsibility is acted upon by the federal government. So I think, you know, in my dream world, could the states take action, you know, legal, meaningful action? Sure. Do I think that that's our reality or it has any prospect of being our reality in the short term? I certainly don't. So I think that the states, I think, may have the fortuity at the moment of dealing with an administration that may be more open to considering their concerns than the last administration, which took the position that the states were not only limited by federal law that was on the books, but by President Obama's enforcement policies. I think the states, at least I would assume until we see otherwise, that the states may find a more open ear in terms of what their concerns are with the Obama administration. But I would not expect this to become a state enforcement responsibility or there to be meaningful state legal action. I think this is going to be controlled by federal law, federal policy, and federal enforcement action. I wish that were not the case, but I think that's how it's going to be.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'm not seeing any questions right now. I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, February 29th. That call will be a Courthouse Steps Teleforum on the Supreme Court case, Packingham versus North Carolina. This call will feature Ilya Shapiro, Senior Fellow in Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute. Oh, it looks like we have another caller. Go ahead.
Hi. My name is Dagmar Rick. I'm an immigration attorney. What I do not understand is we claim on national security, but all the applications, especially also for these seven countries, first go through Homeland Security, and it takes about a year to get it approved, and then it goes to the State Department, to the National Visa Center, and there it takes anywhere for a spouse maybe 2 years, or for a relative of your family, it takes between 10 and 15 years for these people to be approved. So how much longer do we want to wait and vetting these people? If they wait already, interviews have been canceled where people waited already for 8 years or 9 years to get an interview. So what should the policy do any better, or what is in the planning to get these people any visas and make the government or this country any safer?
I mean, my thoughts on that are that, you know, the idea that we have a dubious vetting process right now is just belied by the fact that from these seven countries that are targeted, we have not had a deadly terrorist attack carried out by a national of any of these seven countries. So if the vetting process is so just cursory and a failure, you would expect it would be exploited by people in much larger numbers than we've seen. And, you know, as far as how we can, you know, how it could be improved, I don't think that the administration is necessarily interested in improving the vetting process as much as decreasing the number of people who are coming from these countries. Now, why do I say that? I just take the president at his word when he said that he wanted to suspend the entry of Muslim immigrants to the United States. And now, obviously, he's not suspending all Muslims at this point, but the idea that the intention of this is not to reduce Muslim immigration is, I think, pretty obviously not true.
Yeah, I would just say in response to that that while I was not a fan of Trump's call for a categorical ban during the campaign, I also understood him to say, until we can figure out what the hell is going on, or I think I'm quoting him pretty close to what he exactly said. And from both hearing that and from speaking and even working with some people inside the campaign, my understanding has been that there is an effort to distinguish between Sharia supremacist Muslims whose beliefs are counter-constitutional versus pro-constitutional Muslims who would be obvious value added and are value added to our society, and whether there is a way consistent with the law to vet for that. And I think, you know, all this is why I said at the start, I think that all this arguing we're doing about whether a national origin ban is something that can be upheld or not is really beside the point from where we're headed toward and where we actually need to have the debate, which is whether you can do ideologically based vetting. I'm not here, as I said during my remarks, to argue for the policy necessarily behind the executive order. I think, for example, the application of it to lawful permanent residents who go through a much more exacting vetting than anything that I imagine the administration would ultimately in its dreams come up with in terms of vetting for visas was very, very foolish. and it was not policy that made the country safer, even if it may have been legally defensible. So, you know, I know that as we have this discussion, it's kind of like, you know, trying to drill a nail into a pail of water. On the one hand, we're talking about what's legally justifiable. On the other hand, we're talking about what makes policy sense. And I think we all realize that the place that the grounds that we're having the argument on now is different from where it ultimately ends up, which is whether you can do ideological vetting or not. If you can't, I don't really see belaboring the point. I would then quite agree with you that we're already doing a lot of vetting for refugees, and it takes them a long time to get in the country as it is. We could be taking a lot longer time, and I wouldn't feel any safer if we weren't vetting for the right thing. So to me, that's where it comes down to.
I would add that, you know, it takes such a long time, but a lot of that is the back and forth paperwork. You know, we've had people, Tafshin Malik from the San Bernardino shooting, she was vetted, she slipped through the system. I feel like the vetting needs to be a lot more personal. There are things and markers and cues that I can pick up in a conversation that somebody within an agency probably would never be able to pick up. So it has to be a lot more personal. There needs to be more dialogue. And there is the question of once people are in, do we continue engaging them so that we can pick up on these red flags, whether someone is struggling to acculturate, whether someone is becoming radicalized, and that may be a question or a conversation for a future point. But there needs to be a lot more engagement, because on the one hand, I agree that if someone's really in dire circumstances, they shouldn't have to wait 8 years. Their entire life is on hold. But on the other hand, you know, just letting people come in without really understanding who's coming in sets us up for a bigger failure down the road.
All right, I'll just move right ahead to the next caller. Caller, go ahead.
Hello, my name is Giovanni Johnson, and I had a question regarding the 1965 law and its modern interpretation of it today. This question was, I think, directed towards Mr. Beer. Forgive me, it's my first telephone call, so getting used to this idea. The 1965 law, it had specific provisions in regards to abolishing any sort of national origin, any discrimination against national origin, and abolish the quota system based on those national origins. Mr. Beer, you had mentioned that there was an Obama-era reinterpretation of that. Am I correct?
No. So what Andy and I were discussing was a 2015-era changes to the visa waiver program. And those changes required people who are coming to the United States as tourists to obtain a visa in order to come. And it was from these seven countries that the Obama administration and Congress identified as countries of concern that were required to go through this extra process in order to obtain entry to the United States. So they had to get a visa. So it didn't actually apply to, those changes did not apply to what we're talking about here, which is the immigrant visas, people who are coming to be lawful permanent residents. That portion, the 1965 Act, wasn't affected by that 2015 visa waiver program changes.
All right, that's it. Thank you.
All right, I'll make another call for questions. To request the floor, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'll make another brief announcement. This is just a reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls. And you can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, which is fedsoc.org. And also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. Looks like we have another caller.
First, I want to thank everybody for putting on this really good question. This is Roger Candelaria. And Andrew particularly raised the issue about people that are resistant to assimilation. And I'm not sure that our government ever addresses how we make it easier for people to assimilate and the size of communities that they're placed in and the access they have to media, television, and everything that enables them to avoid ever having to engage with the American civil society. I'd invite any of the panelists to comment.
Yeah, I would just, Roger, I would just say that, you know, there are some things that you try to make the best government policy that you can make for under the circumstances, but you have to be, I think you have to have a little humility in recognizing that there are certain cultural problems that government just is not, it's not equipped. It can address them in some ways. I don't think it can solve them. And the problem that you're referring to, which I think is a very real problem, seems to me that it's a more cultural problem than it is a legal problem, and it's going to be very difficult for the government to address by passing particular laws.
I would just go ahead. I'm sorry.
I would say that I agree with Andrew that it's definitely a cultural problem, and it's two points. One is that we, the government, and the media, we continually work with the sort of I want to say Islamist organizations. So we work with CARE, we work with ISNA. We repeatedly recognize those platforms as the only valid forms of Muslim representation, and they're not. They don't represent all of Muslims. And secondly, we see government continually working with mosques, local mosques that are theological sort of hotbeds, rather than working with the community. So rather than dealing with just specific types of organizations or just a specific mosques that have imams coming in from overseas, work with the communities that are already a subculture of freethinkers. I want to give you one specific example. Here locally in Orange County, we have an amazing group of women who started their own organization a couple years ago because they did not find any representation within the mosque. And so if those voices could be empowered, if those communities could be empowered so that they have more platforms, more agency, more resources to draw a bigger crowd, I think we would definitely see an internal subcultural shift.
What I was going to say was that I think the United States does have the best assimilation system in the world. Compared to Europe, for example, having birthright citizenship is a huge advantage for the United States because it means that the second generation knows growing up that they are an American, that they're part of our national identity, as opposed to many Muslims in Europe who are second generation individuals who are not considered German or not considered French or not considered Belgian. So ultimately, that creates a very toxic environment where people are not seeing themselves as being part of the larger culture. I think our free market is also a big benefit compared to Europe, where they heavily subsidize welfare and don't require work the way that the United States does in order to succeed. So I do think the United States has a better system of assimilation than other countries. And if there's any country that can exercise as a moderating influence on Islam around the world, it's the United States.
The question I would ask, David, is why do we see, and as a Muslim, I'm South Asian, I'm Pakistani and Afghan, I see this, I have been raised to see this, and I see it all around me all the time. Why are second-generation Muslims more driven by identity politics? They're wearing the hijab, where back home we would never wear the hijab. Mm-hmm. They're, when it comes down to it, you know, they may have the Valley accent, they may dress Americanized, you know, they do everything that quote-unquote is American. But when the line gets drawn and they're supposed to pick a side between what's seen as an affront to Islam or Muslim identity versus truly embracing secular values, we see them shift more towards defending Islam. or taking up the sort of torch of that identity. Why are we seeing more women covered up? Why is hijab now a monolithic representation of what it means to be a Muslim woman? And that's a big concern. Why are second-generation Muslims becoming more, quote-unquote, Islamic in the fashion of Islamic monoliths versus secularism?
Well, I haven't seen any numbers that distinguish between the two, and I'd be happy to accept correction or be referred to what the actual figures are for first-generation versus second-generation Muslims in the United States. But what we have seen, and Pew has done several polls over the last decade or so that have asked U.S. Muslims their opinions on various things regarding religion and social issues, and on every single metric, they're becoming more liberal as time has gone on, despite the high rate of Muslim immigration to the United States right now relative to prior years. On the question of whether or not homosexuality, for example, should be accepted, we've seen a dramatic increase in those in the Muslim proportion, from about 25% to about 45%, who say that it should be accepted, which is now a plurality among all Muslims in the United States. So we have seen a shift. We have seen improvement. I'm not going to argue that it's complete. I haven't seen figures on the divide between first and second generation Muslims, but I'll take your point that we should, continue to encourage assimilation into the second generation.
Problem with polls is the same problem with extreme vetting. Is it's one thing if you sit there and you ask a person a question of what do you believe, what do you think is right. Those answers are very simple, and of course people give the answer they think sounds right. But when you see practice, when you are raised in an environment, when you're raised as a Muslim, when you're raised in a community of Muslims, you see the same sort of pattern of behavior. Where in the conversations, which is why I think in extreme vetting we need to have more conversations, the default attitude is one of exclusion. And the most obvious way that we can look at this, you know, beyond polls, which again tend to be not a true representation of the narrative, we see the way that secular Muslims, free-thinking Muslims, Ahmadiyya Muslims are treated by the majority of Sunni Muslims that come from this sort of Diobandi and Salafi background. That we saw with the Oscars most recently, where, who was it, Mahershala Ali, he's a Muslim. As soon as he came out as an Ahmadiyya Muslim, there was a backlash against him because he was not a Muslim. We see within our Muslim community, we see takfir, which is basically outcasting myself as a Muslim because I'm critical of Islamism, which is an ideology. It's not part of the faith itself. So we see this hesitation to really adopt the number one, the most pivotal value, which is freedom of religion, freedom of speech within our own community. So we can sit there and we can say, you know, these are the polls say. But what the polls say versus what people are actually doing, the practices that they're taking are two different things right now.
Well, we've run up on our time. I was wondering, would you guys like to make some brief closing remarks before we finish the call?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. If you don't mind me starting off, I would start off by saying that my view doesn't necessarily reflect everyone at the Cato Institute, but the reality is here that the law is pretty clear in this area that that Congress has prohibited discrimination based on national origin. That's exactly what we're dealing with in this executive order, and we have heard that the new executive order will likely retain that aspect of it. While it's temporary, the executive order asserts the authority to make it permanent. And that's really the objection that I'm raising is not the length of time, but the authority to really exercise discretion in a manner that is in violation of the statute. Thank you.
This is Andy again. I just think that we're arguing. I respectfully disagree with David's take on whether the question is so clear. I actually think it's clearer the other way, but I guess we'll ultimately see if, as he says, the next executive order mirrors this one in a number of ways. But
I just can't help but think that the million-dollar question here is not whether you can vet for national origin, it's whether you can vet for ideology. Legally, that may also end up being the much more explosive question, but I think it's ultimately the one that we have to answer. And by the time we get around to it, I think this will all seem long ago and far away.
Here, I would say that I completely agree with Andy. The first executive order is a layered approach to a larger problem, and again, that, and I cannot stress this enough, that problem is ideology. You know, we can look at race and nationality, and that's not what we're trying to tackle here. We're trying to tackle an ideology that doesn't wear a uniform, that doesn't have a nation state. It is much more larger than that. So what we need to be focused on is looking beyond the old paradigm. So if we're looking at statute, 202A, for example, which is what David was bringing up, it doesn't fit the current problem. So we need to be thinking in new systems of thought, new models for addressing the current problem that we have, which is ideological.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.